Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is like 1:03 p.m. and it's Wednesday, March 16, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Alex Beebe Goudis from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, Representative Christ Tompkins, who is with us on the phone, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Bill 331, Self-Storage Units, Lien Sales, sponsored by Representative Tuck. This is the first hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the bill is Representative Tuck and his staff, Mike Mason. Please come forward. Identify yourselves for the record. You may begin your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for allowing me to present House Bill 331. My name is Representative Chris Tuck from South Central Anchorage, the Diamond Business District, District 23. And what House Bill 331 hopes to do is modernize the lien law for Alaska when it comes to self-storage facilities. There are about 150 self-storage facilities in Alaska. Currently, Alaska is the only state in the nation without some sort of lien law specific to the self-storage industry. Storage liens are the national standard for settling disputes between self-storage facility owners and unit renters. Much the same way that we have a Landlord-Tenant Act in the state of Alaska, this storage liens include protections for both parties. Storage liens are an important tool that self-storage facility owners can use to satisfy debts incurred by self-storage unit renters that do not pay rental charges or fail to comply with the terms of the rental agreement. House Bill 331 gives facility owners the right to enforce a storage lien after a unit renter has been continuously in default for at least 10 days. And just for the record, 10 days is the minimum number of days that must elapse before the facility owner starts the lien process. It's highly unlikely that the lien process would begin that soon, but we've made that the bare minimum. Additionally, House Bill 331 gives facility owners the right to dispose of unit property if a unit renter does not cure a default and pay the amount due by the deadline in the lien notice. The bill details how and when facility owners can dispose of the contents of a storage unit.
Take a brief pause to recognize at 1:06 p.m. we're joined by Representative Kirka and Representative Snyder, my vice chair. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Protection for the self-storage unit renters. Facility owners would be required to include details of the storage lien process and rental agreements, including the method by which the facility owner may enforce the lien. And facility owners would be required to provide an itemized statement to unit renters of the facility's owner's claim and how the unit renter can cure a default. The bill also allows tenants to receive lien notices by email. Email is the most is how most tenants across the country receive notices, especially if they've been traveling. Facility owners would be also required to give unit renters time to settle a default before taking possession of the private property in a storage unit. And the bill includes a section that details how the unit renter may redeem their property before it is disposed of by the facility owner. And if the unit property is disposed of and there are excess disposal proceeds, then the unit renter must be notified and the excess proceeds must be held for a period of 1 year after the disposal sale. Facility owners would be required to keep a written record of when and how the facility owner disposed of the unit property, and that record must be kept for 1 year. And then unit renters must allow the former unit renter to review the written record. There is a notification requirement. House Bill 331 includes provisions governing notification requirements between facility owners and unit renters. The bill requires facility owners to call the unit renter and mail notices to the renter's postal address and email address. Facility owners seeking to dispose of unit property as part of a storage lien must publish a notice of sale in a newspaper in the judicial district in which the storage facility is located. And facility owners must also advertise the sale one time a week for 2 weeks in a commercially reasonable manner that is likely to attract at least three bidders who are not related to the facility owner or each other. The bill also details the information that must be included in the publication, advertisement, and notice of sale, and the facility owner shall hold the sale not less than 5 days after the publication or advertisement of the sale. And then dealing with restricted property, House Bill 331 also includes protections to ensure that restricted property is turned over to the law enforcement. And that restricted property is defined as firearms, ammunition, or a controlled substance. The lien notice must include a statement noting that the law enforcement agency will be notified if restricted property is found in the rental unit, and the unit renter must be informed when restricted property is turned over to the law enforcement agency. Unit renters can file a claim with the law enforcement agency for return of a firearm or ammunition, and unit renters do have 1 year to file a claim. So that's pretty much what the bill does. We do have some invited testimony from Daniel Bryant, who's legal and legislative counsel for the Self-Storage Association Nationwide, to answer any questions that I may not be able to answer, Mr. Chair.
So the committee's aware, I think the bill presenter's request has been that we allow Mr. Bryant to make his invited testimony, which will probably provide us more details about the bill than we're hearing from the bill sponsor. And so I will then ask Mr. Bryant, the legal and legislative counsel from the Self-Storage Association, who is with us by teleconference. If you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record, you can proceed with your invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Bryant, and I'm legal and legislative counsel to the National Self-Storage Association based in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 331, a bill meant to bring a self-storage lien law to Alaska. I thought it would be helpful just to provide a little bit of background and context just kind of on how the self-storage business works, and just provide a bit of an overview of lien laws and how they work, and then get into some of the specifics of what's proposed in this bill specifically. So as was previously mentioned by Representative Tuck, there's about 150 facilities in the state. Almost 100% of storage operators are small businesses based in Alaska. We do count amongst our membership larger publicly traded companies such as Public Storage and Extra Space, but those entities do not have a presence in the state. Alaska, generally speaking, is one or two store smaller operators. So how does the self-storage, how does it work? The self-storage operator and tenant have a commercial landlord-tenant relationship. A broad swath of consumers use self-storage for a variety of reasons, everything from simply just not having enough space to accommodate Christmas decorations to potentially some other life transition, such as death or divorce that necessitates a temporary usage of storage. So once a unit size is selected, the consumer will execute either in person or electronically a rental agreement. This is a contract that governs the relationship between the operator and the tenant. All rental agreements are month-to-month tenancies that renew upon the mutual desire of both parties, so consumers are free to terminate and vacate as they please. This is not a situation where somebody gets locked into a multi-month or a multi-year commitment. I just want to emphasize that the vast majority of these tenancies are successful for both parties. Goods are stored and rent is timely paid. But just to provide a little bit of background on the lien law specifically, so 49 states in the District of Columbia have a self-storage lien law. Alaska is presently the last state without one on the books, so to speak. So self-storage lien laws provide a non-judicial foreclosure process for addressing situations in which tenants fail to pay their rent and the storage operator must sell the tenant's property to satisfy the operator's lien for those past due rents and fees. Statutory liens are important to provide a basic legal framework and guardrails to protect both the owner and occupant. Again, the bill, and we'll get more into some of the specifics here, but
Bryant,
we'll ensure that several steps are taken.
Bryant, if you'll take about a 10-second pause, I want to recognize that Representative Drummond joined us at 1:12 p.m. Please continue.
Oh, thank you. So the bill would ensure that several steps are taken before the sale, starting with the execution of a written rental agreement that informs the occupant of the lien and the fact that the property may be sold or disposed of upon default. Also, the occupant would be notified several times before any sale or disposal happens. So I do want to emphasize that national data from our organization indicates that self-storage operators sell approximately 1 to 3% of lease spaces annually. So To state it differently, 97% to 99% of tenants will use their space per the rental agreement and never have their belongings subject to a lien sale. So again, this is an infrequently used procedure, but it is necessary for the successful operation of a facility. And the primary goal here, these are the furthest thing from a moneymaker. An owner would be lucky to get 25 or 30 cents on the dollar relative to the debt owed, but the primary goal here is to recover the space, which can then be re-rented to a paying customer. Wanted to briefly address service members, and specifically the Service Members Civil Relief Act, there are protections that exist for service members in all 50 states, including Alaska. So everything that we're talking about today would not apply to an active duty service member. It's, incumbent upon, and we certainly recommend to all of our members that they have a provision in the rental agreement that specifically queries whether or not the tenant is an active duty service member. And even beyond that, even if there isn't an express disclosure, we still recommend that members do a search to the DOD's manpower data center prior to any sale, just to ensure that there isn't any issue. If there's failure to comply, carries both criminal and civil penalties. But again, just wanted to highlight here that nothing that we're talking about today would cover active duty service member, and that this federal statute provides protection in all 50 states, again, including Alaska. So with that background, wanted to get a little bit into some of the highlights of what's in this proposed legislation, looking at some of the rental agreement requirements, requirements for default notices, advertising, sale, and then finally how any excess proceeds are handled, should there be any. So the bill would require that the rental agreement and the lease be a written document agreed upon and executed by both parties. The lien attaches on the date on which the property is placed in the unit. So again, storage owners will be legally obligated to ensure that the rental agreement contained a statement in bold type notifying the unit renter of the existence of the storage lien. And again, just to reiterate, the occupant must be notified of the lien upon execution of the rental agreement. And failure to do so means that the owner's lien is not going to be enforceable. So moving on to default notices. After being informed of the owner's lien rights in the rental agreement, if the tenant defaults, the owner must send a notice to the occupant regarding the default and provide an opportunity to cure. Required notice must be sent to the occupant's postal address and via email to the extent it's provided in the rental agreement. And beyond the statutory minimum or what's envisioned in this particular bill, just as a matter of practice, every owner in every state is going to make several more attempts beyond that. The objective is to always figure out a way to remedy the payment dispute in a manner that doesn't necessitate sale of the tenant's good. As I mentioned previously, none of these are money makers, and every owner wants to avoid doing so to the extent possible. But as Representative Tuck hit on earlier, just wanted to mention to you on email and just talk about some of the national trends and things that we've seen in other states. But looking first at email, and just to reiterate, approximately 50% of self-storage tenants are in transition. Again, this might be because of a divorce or some other dislocation event that necessitates some need for storage on a temporary basis. And again, unlike physical addresses, obviously emails typically remain the same when an individual moves. So the proposed legislation gives tenants the choice to receive lien notices via email, and if it's provided, then the owner would be required legally to provide that notice via both traditional mail and email. And then again, nationally, this is something that we see in the vast majority of states. And we hear from all of our member owners nationally that tenants are generally just much more responsive to email, just again, because of the immediacy as well as the accessibility of email. So on the next slide, you can see where we are in terms of the adoption status in several other states as it relates to notice via email. Turning next to late fees, the proposed legislation includes a late fee standard of up to $20 or 20% of the monthly rent, whichever is greater. From our perspective, we think the legislation protects consumers for providing an amount that is fair and reasonable while still compensating the storage owner for lost revenue. And again, just in terms of national trends, 34 states recognize a late fee safe harbor and statute. which you can see on the next slide. And do just want to emphasize for all the states that are highlighted in yellow there, again, the statute just doesn't speak specifically to late fees, but there is nothing preventing an owner from assessing late fees. So we just think, you know, it makes sense for the statute to speak to late fees to some degree, just to provide some, again, basic guardrails and protections. We have heard, you know, these certainly are isolated incidents, but certain owners electing to charge rates that we just feel are completely unreasonable. So we think it makes sense just to provide, again, sort of a baseline in the statute that sort of instructs in terms of what is fair and reasonable.
Mr. Bryant, on this particular slide,
yes.
When you reference a safe harbor, who is getting the safe harbor? That the person that's renting the storage space or the owner?
It's primarily, in terms of the challenge, it would be the owner. Basically to say if you charge a late fee within something, you know, within $20 or 20%, the statute is basically saying that it's fair and reasonable. So the safe harbor would be for the owner.
Thank you. You can proceed. I just want a little clarity
on that before you went too far. Yeah, no, thank you. So finally, turning to remedies again, this will be after multiple attempts have been exhausted to contact the tenants. Again, you know, beyond just email and traditional mail, to the extent there's any capabilities, text message or anything else, you know, owners are going to do everything that they can, you know, within reason to try to contact the tenant. Because again, the objective is to always, you know, remedy the issue in a manner that doesn't necessitate a sale. But in the event, you know, the occupant is just completely unresponsive, the bill envisions three specific remedies. First is towing, the second is sale, and then finally disposal of a very low value property. So turning first to towing, many storage operators generally do not want to go through the process for selling titled property. It can be rather cumbersome, and many owner-operators are not frequently called upon to do so. The proposed legislation provides operators with an option to have certain property towed after default, and the towing company would be required to comply with the process for towing a titled vehicle to the extent the occupant didn't redeem the property from the tow company. And 43 states allow operators to tow vehicles under similar circumstances, which you can see the adoption status there on the next slide. And then the next slide is just the specific language and the cite to it in the bill. So next, and this will certainly be the most common, most default issues will be resolved through a sale. Again, lien sales nationally are not money makers for storage owners. Again, most are lucky to get, you know, 25 or 30 cents on the dollar. And we certainly hear from many owners that they don't even realize that much. But again, the primary goal here is to return the unit back to inventory so it can be rented to another paying customer. But with that said, you know, operators certainly have every incentive to advertise an upcoming sale in the most effective means possible for their community to maximize the sale price. As, you know, maximizing the sale price basically benefits all parties involved to the extent that, you know, it realizes the high price that will go to drawing down the debt. Admittedly a rare circumstance, but to the extent the sale yields more than the debt owed, then that actually needs, you know, assuming there aren't any lien holders or other parties that are entitled to payment, those funds actually have to be held for the former occupant and returned to them. And again, the statute envisions that that there would be a required notice that would be sent to the occupant to apprise them of the excess proceeds and to inform them that they should come to collect. So again, there's two options in this specific bill in terms of the method of advertising. One being either in a newspaper of general circulation or conducting it in another commercially reasonable manner that is likely to attract three independent bidders who are not related to the owner or each other. So, again, providing options for an owner to basically select the method of advertising that makes the most sense for their specific business, sort of knowing their individual community and the individual clientele who might be, you know, interested in bidding and whatever method would be most helpful in terms of apprising the local community of the upcoming sale. So finally, turning to where and how the sale is conducted, and again, this is, you know, common in every self-storage statute nationally. It will say something to the effect of that it needs to be held at the facility. at a nearby suitable place or on a publicly accessible internet website. And as I believe was already mentioned by Representative Takis, the facility owner has to wait, not hold the sale for at least 5 days after the advertisement. And importantly, I do want to note that until the sale is final, every occupant has the right to exercise their redemption rights to come in and pay whatever the outstanding debt that is owed to the owner, and that will immediately stop the sale. So until the sort of metaphorical gavel falls and the sale is finalized and the property is paid for and cleared out, the occupant has the right to come in and exercise their redemption rights prior to any final sale. Again, just in terms of some national trends, just wanted to mention that it's becoming increasingly popular for these sales to be conducted online. Certainly numerous websites to conduct these sales for the industry. And these sales can expand the audience of potential bidders by allowing bidders to submit bids over the course of several days without attending a one-day sale in person. And obviously, increasing bidders can increase the likelihood of higher bids. And as I mentioned, that's beneficial to both the owner to pay down the debt, and obviously in some rare circumstances, if there is any excess, then that obviously benefits the former tenant as well. So in 36 states expressly allow for online sales, and the remaining 49 expressly permit for on-site sales. And then finally, in terms of the third remedy envisioned by the statute is the disposal of very low-value units. So the bill says that an owner can dispose of all or part of very low-value units. Again, most owners will elect to sell unless it's clearly filled with refuse or other garbage to at least attempt to recoup some of the debt. Obviously, even getting $50, generally speaking, is going to be, infinitely more desirable than zero. But, we certainly do hear from plenty of operators and owners nationally that there are plenty of times where, basically the occupant will come and gather all of the desirable items and then basically leave, functionally what is garbage behind. So this provision would afford them the opportunity to just go ahead and dispose of the contents of that as opposed to having to go through a sale process that, again, if it's just garbage, isn't likely to realize any amount at sale anyway. And then so finally, just a couple more slides, and then obviously happy to answer any questions. So after the sale, the bill outlines the order of priority payment from the proceeds of the sale. First going to pay down the fees and costs associated with the sale, then the outstanding debt owed to the owner, then to any lien holder to the extent that there is any, and then finally, again, any excess being held for the benefit of the unit renter. Again, as Representative Tuck already mentioned, the bill requires that storage owners keep records for at least 1 year and provide access to those records to the former occupant. So again, just briefly in closing, self-storage lien laws, again, provide a non-judicial foreclosure process to address situations in which tenants fail to pay their rent and the storage owner must sell the tenant's property to satisfy the owner's lien for past due rents and other fees. Again, it's an infrequently used procedure. Again, the vast majority of tenants will use their unit in accordance with the rental agreement, and all parties are satisfied. But this is certainly necessary for those handful of issues that present itself. And again, from our perspective, a statutory lien law provides sort of an essential framework and guardrails to ensure basic minimum protections for both owners and consumers. And as Alaska is the last remaining state without such a law, we certainly encourage this committee to vote favorably on House Bill 331, and I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions anybody might have. Thank you very much.
Okay. So that brings us to questions from the committee. And as usual, we limit questions a minute per question. Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at section 34.35.665 on page 7, line 6, can you help me understand, in the event that a renter violates this limit on the value of property that they may store in the storage unit, and they do that anyway, and then they are non-responsive and discontinue their payments, and the owner of the unit sells that property, if they sell that property at an amount greater than the max allowed originally for storage, what happens with the difference of that money? Is the owner no longer entitled to that difference once all debts have been paid?
Through the
chair. Thank you for the question.
I think we're going to let, unless you want something else, I thought we'd let Mr. Bryant answer the questions. Mr. Bryant.
Thank you so much for the question. So this is really getting at and ensuring that a unit owner has the ability to limit the value of stored goods. So this is really getting at ensuring that, you know, if somebody doesn't make some claim that they were storing, you know, priceless Van Goghs or other works of art. Again, self-storage really isn't appropriate to store those types of items. So the intent here is to basically put something in statute that confirms that the owner has the ability to put into the rental agreement, and basically per the agreement, you know, an occupant is expressly saying, yes, I understand that I will not store goods in excess of whatever it is. And common in most states for something in the universe of $5,000 to $10,000. So again, this is just providing some protection for the owner to basically prevent against, you know, claims after the fact that there was some issue that led to, you know, the destruction or loss of that property. But somebody isn't making a claim against the owner that the value of the contents of that unit was, you know, $300,000 or something to that effect.
Representative Snyder.
That's helpful context, but I don't think it answered my question in terms of if the unit owner sold that property at a, say, for a large sum that exceeded the max value that could be stored, would the renter still be entitled to those remaining funds after the debt had been paid, or is the amount that could go back to the renter capped at that value that was listed as the max in the agreement? And if I'm not being clear, I can try to restate.
No, and I apologize for not addressing the question. So outside of the context of this, basically anytime a sale is conducted, the owner is entitled to the proceeds from that sale up to the total amount of the debt owed. So just as an example, if the owner was owed $300 and the sale realized $400, that the owner would be entitled to the $300 and that excess $100 to the extent that there wasn't another secured party who claimed an interest in the proceeds. That would be the occupant would be entitled to those. And again, the statute the bill rather envisions that the owner would be required to the extent there are any excess, and even if it was significantly above $100, we'll say for purposes of this, we'll say it's $15,000 in excess above what was owed to the owner. Those $15,000 would be the property of the occupant. And again, the storage owner would have to send notice directly to the tenant, basically apprising them of the fact that a sale was conducted and that there are excess proceeds for which they're entitled to.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And on that same topic, so the bill currently simply says that if the facility owner determines that disposal is not commercially viable, then they can, in essence, do whatever they want with it. You know, I'm just wondering about, you know, there's no reference in that part of the bill to value. It's not that it is below a certain value. It's just that they can't commercially sell it. I could certainly see where something could be.
Representative Eastman, just so we're all tracking, what's the portion of the bill you're referencing?
I'm referencing page 4, line 8.
Okay. I just want to make sure we're all following along.
Yeah, the slide doesn't have a number for me to reference, but it points you there. And I'm wondering, you know, if the value is high, does that just allow the owner to sort of make a determination that, you know, it's inconvenient to commercially sell something because it's, I don't know, a rare item, or you might need to go hire a broker to do it or something like that? Because I know the slide talks about low-value units, but there's nothing in that part of the statute that says that it's a low-value unit. It just says that the facility determines that they don't want to sell it.
Thank you, Representative, for the question. I mean, again, I believe the intent behind the provision is largely to deal with situation in which a unit owner opens the door, and again, it's very clearly, you know, somebody just left a box of garbage behind and took, the valuable contents out of the unit. Even if it was inconvenient, I don't think it would not be commercially viable to sell something, even if it would take the owner, you know, a few additional steps to find an appropriate venue to sell something that might be rare or something else. I think it's really getting at that. We have seen in other states, putting a dollar value in there, basically saying something to the effect of if the owner determines that the unit has a value less than, $300 or something that we've seen in a state like South Carolina, then it affords them this sort of alternative remedy. So that might be something to consider in terms of putting a little bit more specificity on that specific provision.
Thank you. Follow-up. So on that, I'm seeing in the language we're giving the facility owner the ability to make that determination for themselves. Is there some kind of appeal process or way of challenging whether or not the facility owner has made the right determination?
I don't believe that there was anything envisioned in this bill specifically that speaks to what you're getting at. I believe as it's presently written, it basically affords the owner with the ability to make that determination solely.
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And as the bill is currently written, what about a situation where an owner doesn't know the value of the item or they find out later that the item was valued higher than they thought it was? What's their legal remedy in that sort of situation if they've, signed an agreement saying it's below, whatever value it actually is at?
Well, again, we strongly recommend to all of our owners. I will say that this provision is not overly common in other states. Most states just require that a sale occur for basically every unit, regardless of how much it might bring in. But we recommend, even like I just mentioned, in a state like South Carolina, that if it's even remotely borderline, just to go ahead and sell the unit, because that will conclusively determine the value of it, as opposed to the owner sitting in the space of appraiser and trying to make sort of a snap judgment as to the contents of the unit. Again, I think what was really envisioned here by this provision is just to save the owner in the event, again, using my trash example, you literally open up the door and it's, five pizza boxes. Again, that's not going to be something that anyone's going to bid on, and it's just, an inconvenience to have to go through a sale process and advertise a sale and go through it when you know that nobody has any interest in what is functionally trash. So again, I think that's really what it's getting at. But I certainly understand, the concern of the owner sitting in the capacity of appraiser and trying to make a determination of that. So maybe, again, putting a dollar threshold or something on that might address that at least somewhat.
I've got a follow-up on your inquiry, which I'll ask and then come back to Representative Eastman. So let's get a specific example. You've got these five pizza boxes you described, and anybody looks in there and says, looks like garbage to me. But there's also a sketch, and it's a framed sketch, and the person looks at it and thinks, that looks like some goofy sketch that some kid did in elementary school, but it's actually a sketch done by Picasso. And it's valued at $100,000 conservatively in an auction, and so the owner goes in. Owner doesn't know anything about Picasso. It looks like elementary school art to me. And so I'll sell it to my friend, because under this provision I could sell that for – I can make a private sale. I said, look, I got elementary school art. You want it for $10? And somebody says, sure, I'll take it for $10. And now it's been sold. I mean, what's the remedy for the occupant? They just lost their Picasso because somebody didn't know it was a Picasso.
Well, again, in terms of the disposal provision, again, we recommend to all of our members nationally, to the extent there is this type of provision,
I'm specifically asking, what's the remedy of the occupant who just lost their $100,000 Picasso? Because under the terms of this provision, the Representative Eastman points out, if he doesn't think it's worth it, he has the right to sell it. There's nothing else. What's the occupant's remedy here?
Well, if there is some issue with the sale, there's a civil action called a wrongful sale. that basically the occupant can institute against the owner, basically saying you didn't comply with the statute and I have now been damaged to whatever extent. So there would be the opportunity to have redress in the local court of competent jurisdiction.
Representative Eastman, I did mean to get ahead of you on the questioning, but I'll
back to you fine. Now. I appreciate the question. That was where I was going, so I'm done for now.
Okay. Other questions from members of the committee? Representative Sacchetto, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that this bill has been in the making for about 10 years, even before my time. The representative that served before me was working on it. And one of the things, I mean, you hit the nail on the head of why a storage lien bill was necessary. We heard testimony years ago where a woman did have some valuable art. And rather than it being disposed of or even being sold, the owner had kept the art for themselves. And that's what was happening on with a lot of our firearms as well, is notification wasn't going out. Someone falls behind on their rent. The owner happens to know there's firearms in there, and they didn't disclose or didn't even try to reach out to someone. And then the firearms becomes theirs. So this is one of the reasons why it's really important to have terms and conditions spelled out in statute so that people know what their rights are and what to be expected.
Okay, I saw some more hands. Representative Vance, you haven't had questions. Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, could someone speak to the section on page 5, line 11, that talks about the time of holding the cell not less than 5 days after publication? Is 5 days the national recommendation? Is that enough notification? That's my first question, and then I'll have a follow-up after that.
Thank you for the question. I'd say nationally the average is somewhere between probably 5 to 15 days, so somewhere in that range. And I think in the context of online auctions, I think that makes sense. Again, the advertisements will be placed on the same website where ultimately that sale will occur. So it's basically going to be up and running for several days consecutively before the sale happens. So again, from that perspective, just in terms of where technology is sort of moving things, I think the 5 days it certainly is a sufficient amount of time.
Follow up.
Representative Vance.
Would you walk us through kind of the process of the time from someone's rent is due to the time that the storage owner posts a sale and what that would look like in the length of time?
Sure. Yeah. Well, again, to start out with, the bill says that you have to wait 10 days before they're officially in default. So even if, you'd have to wait, I guess, until day 11 to even commence the process. And then, I'm sorry, I'm trying to look through here. I believe that the lien notice says that you have to provide at least a minimum of 21 days after sending the notice for them to be able to secure. And then to go through, again, the advertising process. So, again, in terms of adding that up in total, I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, but I'd certainly be happy to try to put that together. I don't know if Representative Tuck has that close at hand. But, again, from our, just general recommendation for our members, whatever is sort of the baseline minimum contained in the statute in terms of how quickly somebody can potentially proceed. We always encourage people to move on a slower timeline, in the hopes that you'll be able to contact that renter and be able to figure out, the payment dispute. Because again, rushing the process is not advantageous to anybody, because again, at the end of the line, even if you went as fast as you can possibly go in compliance with the statute, the owner again is going to, get a fraction of what is owed to them. So we always caution just to say, try to hold out for as long as you can, if and when it becomes very obvious that the unit renter is not responsive and you're just not going to be able to resolve that payment dispute, then obviously at that time to go ahead. But in terms I apologize, in terms of the specific absolute minimum that that an owner would have to wait. I don't have that in front of me.
Follow up.
Representative Vance.
This question's for the bill sponsor. One of my concerns is, you know, we have a lot of bush Alaska. We have commercial fishermen, people who go, you know, remotely, and they don't get email, and they aren't getting their mail as quickly. And the last thing on their mind is going to be their storage unit. So what kind of protections do we have for these people as far as notification goes and being able to come back and know that they were well-intended, but things were not suddenly sold?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the big debates that we were looking at was whether or not a facility owner is obligated to make a phone call. And I can tell you from my experience this last summer, I did not have internet connection. I did not have access to to mail. And oftentimes I was stranded, not able to get out of some of the places I was at. And so at least with a phone call, even sometimes I was out of cell range, because you know how rural Alaska is, at least I can check my messages when I do get in the cell range. And so, yeah, it's one of those, it's a policy call on if we want to expand that. Yeah, 5 days seems to be something to start off with this piece of legislation.
I would just note, Representative Tuck, this is the first time I've heard you were hard to reach this summer.
Thank you, that's it.
Is that all, Representative Vance?
Yes.
Next, Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on that thread that was also on my mind, particularly if folks are out of even cell service for potentially the period of time where this could actually happen, would there be any value, or have you considered, you know, when you sign an agreement, having the opportunity to indicate that you work in a seasonal job where you may be out of range over X dates, or just so there's some better communication with the owner? Just trying to think of a way to remedy that. And honestly, if you have any insights into how common this is a problem, I think that would also be helpful.
Through the chair, Representative Snyder, I think that's the reason why you'll see that with military families, why the federal government got involved. Right. Because you just, you know, it's just tough for deployed families that all of a sudden have to pick up and leave. And oftentimes, a lot of their personal affairs aren't able to get settled in enough time for making sure that your property is secured or taken care of while you're away. Yeah, you know, this, any tenant can probably negotiate with the landlord. At least we're putting in here bare minimums, because right now we don't have any in there. And so I would suggest that people do negotiate. But like I was saying earlier, it's a policy call if we want to expand that, or if we want to put in any other conditions on there. But I don't think this bill limits someone from modifying a contract and expanding that with their landlord, or with their, in this case, the facility owner.
I have a different topic I can get back into.
No, that's fine. You can keep going.
Just returning back to the phrase commercially viable, was there any consideration, or would you find it useful to include a definition of that in the end of your bill with other phrases?
Yes, and thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Snyder, in a previous version of this bill, we did have where an appraiser would have to appraise the value, and then there was a value threshold. And that's something, again, another policy call if we want to look at that and consider that.
Thank you.
I don't see anyone else. I have a few questions. First, is this a topic upon which the Uniform Laws Commission has taken an opportunity to opine or propose a uniform law about self-storage?
Mr. Chair, I would like to punt on to Mr. Bryant on that one. That's actually a very good question.
Actually, I did intend to direct that to that, and I've got a few other questions about for Mr. Bryant. Mr. Bryant, has the Uniform Laws Commission gotten involved in this matter?
I am not aware of any uniform body getting involved in this. I mean, I will say Just at our association level, we generally, look, to sort of have, it's not really model in the sense they're certainly not identical by any means, but just in terms of sort of basic, provisions, certainly look to have that included in every state in which we're trying to either get a lien law on the books or to get it updated. But in terms of a uniform body getting involved in the process, no, I'm not aware of that.
Have you actually looked at the Uniform Laws website to see if they have one?
I have not.
Okay. Next question for Mr. Bryant, because you're familiar with these laws in all 50 states. What state would you say has the best model for an example of this particular law of the other 49 states?
I think we just recently updated the law in North Dakota. I think that they provide, very sort of, in some ways, simple and easy just to follow, just in terms of what the baseline requirements are, while again still providing, a good amount of consumer protection for the individual unit renter. So I think that would be, a good statute to look at in terms of, something that provides sort of the best model. But again, all of them are different, and there's certainly competing policy interests in various states. So everything ends up, shaking out a little bit differently, just depending upon, the policy decisions that are made there.
All right. Now, the next question is the other 49 states. We've got North Dakota as your current answer to the best example. What's the worst example?
Rhode Island. Just because of it's just a very clunky and very confusing law, just in terms of the method of mailing. It originally says you can send it by email or verified mail, and then later on says you have to send it either by certified mail or you have to effectuate direct process on the tenant. And to the extent you're unable to do that, you have to go through this very lengthy notice via publication requirement in the newspaper, which ends up costing a significant amount of money. We actually just had some correspondence from a member in Rhode Island that they were spending close to $700 on advertisements, which from our perspective, given the significant decline in readership, just ends up being a significant cost center for owners without any real tangible benefit on the other end of it. Just because, again, most no one's going to read that advertisement and come and pay the bill. So I guess, from that perspective, I guess Rhode Island is probably the worst.
All right. Well, I'll be sure to let my cousin who lives in Rhode Island let him know about where he is in terms of self-storage. But actually, that raises the next question I had. Part of the provision talks about a newspaper of general circulation, and actually Rhode Island is probably a great place if you're trying to find a newspaper of general circulation. It's such an enormous state that if you advertise in Providence paper, you're probably covering the newspaper of general circulation. We have a different problem in Alaska. I mean, just for example, if you've got a storage owner in Bethel, which is in the same judicial district as Nome, and under this provision, you could post your notice of general circulation in Nome for a Bethel self-storage unit. I'm just concerned. How do you respond to people who say this notice of a newspaper in general circulation in the judicial district leaves a lot of room for people that should be getting notice not to get notice? How do you deal with that?
Well, thanks for the question. And from our perspective, the newspaper is not providing any form of constructive notice. From our perspective, it's simply an advertising requirements that basically drive bidders to the sale. And so in terms of notification, from our perspective, that's already been accomplished, again, through the execution of the rental agreement, which specifically outlines the owner's rights upon default, and the direct outreach from the owner to the occupant via the required notices and the additional measures that will be taken, again, because they're going to do everything reasonably within their power to make sure that they are able to contact the unit renter. Again, from our perspective, if all of those attempts are unsuccessful, the idea that the renter themselves or some family member or relative or friend might happen upon the specific advertisement, which then prompts them to call the unit renter, which then prompts the unit renter to reach out to the owner, is a fairly unlikely scenario. So again, from our perspective, the purpose of the advertisement, whether that be done in a, you know, another commercially reasonable manner that, that drives three bidders to the sale, or done in a newspaper of general circulation, again, from our perspective, the intent there is really to drive bidders to the sale, not to apprise the unit renter of the upcoming sale.
And then I think the last question, then I'll get back to Representative Eastman, who is in the queue. You had referenced when my earlier question about the renter and his remedies for the scenario with the Picasso that was sold for $10. You referenced a place where they could bring a lawsuit. Is that specifically identified in this bill, or is that somewhere else? And if it's in the bill, if you could let me know the section of the bill.
It is not in the bill as far as I'm aware.
So is there a section of Alaska law you were referencing to that type of lawsuit?
That is just a common lawsuit, you know, a common title associated with that type of lawsuit nationally. In terms of specific sections of Alaska code, I don't have that off the top, but I'd certainly be happy to dig around and provide that to the committee.
That's all I have at this point. Representative Eastman. Oh, Mr. Mason, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, not that I have much expertise, but I do have it printed up. It's AS 34.35 that deals with liens, and it's a very detailed section of law that basically goes through how liens are handled in the state of Alaska. And you have to go through the court process and all of that, but I can make that available.
Okay. Representative Eastman?
Thank you, through the chair. So there's a definition of restricted property in the bill. I'm wondering, where do we get that definition of restricted property from?
Where are we looking?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's something that I had worked with our alleged legal drafters to come up with a definition that basically looked at anything that was illegal in nature, but then specifically with firearms. Because a firearm in itself isn't illegal, but a firearm may answer an investigation in a crime that may have committed. And because of the way that firearms have been handled in the past with facility owners, we just thought it would be a good idea to include that with the with that definition.
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
And now, is the goal there to capture any potentially illegal property, for example, cigarettes or marijuana or something, or are we just focusing in on firearms and ammunition?
Through the chair, firearms, ammunition, and controlled substances.
Follow up.
Representative Eastman.
And so are we considering cigarettes and marijuana controlled substances, or what are we considering controlled substances?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I have to grab the statutes real quick, but we specifically use controlled substances referred to in Alaska State Statute 1171-900.
Follow up while we're waiting for that.
Representative, I think that doesn't include cigarettes. I'm sure that cigarettes are not or tobacco, I shouldn't say cigarettes, but tobacco is not a controlled substance under Title 11.
Sure.
Well, marijuana is a little more complicated.
Yeah, that would be a question. If we're not talking cigarettes, you know, does our lawful to possess marijuana get caught up under that definition? But while we're looking for that, I'm also curious. So in the bill, we have a requirement now that we're putting on law enforcement to store ammunition for at least a year, and I'm just wondering does that make sense? Does law enforcement want to be storing ammunition for a year? And if someone has their ammunition stored by law enforcement for a year, does law enforcement get to charge them for storing their ammunition for a year, or I don't know? I'm trying to understand that one.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't know how to answer that one in regards to what they would like to do or what they wouldn't like to do. But after a year, they can't auction it off. And I know that they do have storage facilities. that they hold on to belongings, personal belongings, and they do have regular auctions.
Mike Mason, through the chair, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. So the legislation has the one-year time frame for the unit renter to file a claim, but they can file the claim before that. So basically, the unit renter can file a claim with law enforcement for the return of the firearm or the ammunition up to the 1 year.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman?
And I'm curious, in other states, do in those situations, does law enforcement generally charge someone to get their ammunition back or their firearm back? Or is this a way somebody can just say, hey, you know, I don't want to pay the storage owner. I want law enforcement to store it for me for free.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if someone was that devious, I suppose they probably could.
Okay.
If I may, so essentially the
identify yourself.
I'm Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. So the restricted property would be turned over to the law enforcement office, to the law enforcement agency, by the facility owner as part of the lien. So at that point, the law enforcement takes possession of the firearm or the ammunition or the controlled, well, let's skip the controlled substance for now. And then the unit renter, basically, it would be their responsibility to claim their weapon or claim their ammunition. So it basically, once the weapon or ammunition is turned over to law enforcement, it takes the facility owner out of that process and puts it back on the onus of the unit renter.
And did we get an answer to the controlled substance question?
Yes, and through the chair, Representative Eastman. So the 1171-900 falls underneath our criminal law, and it's basically controlled substances and what... there's different classification of substances and which ones require what type of credentials or professional accreditation. For example, practitioner, that's defined in here. So it's a bunch of definitions, and it's a few pages. But they have, for example, they have a definition for hashish oil. They have... definition for, here, let me just read this one. Controlled substance means a drug, substance, or immediate precursor included in the schedule set out, and then there's this whole schedule system from 1171-140 to 1171-190, or included in those schedules by an emergency regulation adopted in AS 1171-125, which I think we passed probably about 6 years ago. Because that was where synthetic drugs kept changing on us, so we allowed that provision in there.
Thank you.
I'll get to Representative Eastman. I would speculate that for the unit owner, the illegal substances, unless you found a fairly large quantity, they might very well not know there was anything illegal in there. Might be illegal substances in there. But you know, the notion that if you saw a bottle of pills that you knew it was an illegal substance might not even come close to registering.
And sure.
The time to figure that out. Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, it seems to me that a lot of these situations that I've heard about, typically, I remember my wife was telling me a story about when her dad used to go and bid on these rental units' contents. There's a group of people that go out and do that. They bet on the contents and hope to find something of value that to make it worth their troubles. This is, of course, many years ago, before he passed away. But it seems to me that, from what I've heard, that typically the landlord will advertise the contents of the unit, not the actual contents, but advertise the units coming up for auction in terms of its contents, without actually knowing what's in there. It sounds like we're asking now a heavy inspection of the contents of the unit and handing over things to this law enforcement agency or this person over here. Or it seems like we're getting in the weeds on this a little bit. How does that affect those landlords that simply just want to get on with their business of renting out to a new tenant and want to get the unit cleaned out as soon as possible. Is it normal for them to go through with a fine-tooth comb of the entire – because ammo can be stored in very small containers sometimes. It just seems like we're getting into the point of really micromanaging things here.
Not just ammo, but some guns are quite small too.
Representative Kirka, yeah, this probably doesn't perfect those procedures in that particular case. But at least we have something on there. If you happen to open up a storage unit and you just see a lot of guns in there, then you know. But if it's something that's concealed, something that's not so obvious, it's probably something that's going to get slipped through the cracks.
Follow up?
So what would happen in the situation, through the chair, where the scenario I was talking about, where the landlord just says, hey, here's the unit, we're opening the padlock, you can, because typically you can't go in. If you're a bidder, you just stand on the outside and see what you can see. What would happen to the landlord that didn't inspect, and it turns out there was $10,000 worth of guns and ammo, which is not that hard to put in a storage unit? Would they be in violation of the law? Would they be liable for the loss of those firearms and stuff that has now gone into the possession of the person who purchased the contents of the unit? If they didn't know, out of ignorance, they didn't know it was in there.
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Mike Mason, Staff Representative Chris Stuck. I think Mr. Bryant might be able to shed some light on how this is handled across the nation.
Mr. Bryant, you're up.
Thank you for the question. I appreciate it. I think some of the key language probably is if the facility owner discovers. So I think it's at least reasonable to make the argument that, you know, in the event that they, you know, did a sort of cursory review of the unit, it wasn't glaringly apparent that those items were in there and then went ahead and sold. I think, again, if they just didn't discover it through that process, that they probably would be in a relatively safe position. In terms of nationally, we generally speaking don't see provisions that speak in such detail to how firearms and other contraband are dealt with. So this would be somewhat unique to Alaska, just in terms of how firearms would be dealt with.
Representative Kirk, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So earlier we talked about the notice requirements and how short they could be for putting a lien and then disposing of the property. We talked about travel and hunting in Alaska. What about a situation where you have, say, an individual has collected valuable things throughout their life, they put these items in a storage unit, and they die. And they have descendants who they've bequeathed their earthly belongings to. How do they get notified? How does the estate get notified? And how is their, I guess, equitable process for those who should be taking ownership of property? But then, because it seems like we're talking about a really tight turnaround here on some of these valuables in terms of notice.
Thank you, Representative Kirk, and through the chair. I'd like to actually bring on my legal legislative counsel with Mr. Bryant on that.
We'll just go on the assumption that Mr. Bryant's answering the questions, and you can add in, but we'll let Mr. Bryant take these questions. I recognize he's our resident expert. Mr. Bryant. Well,
thank you for the question. I think largely this becomes a question of, you know, whoever is sitting, whoever is sitting as executor to basically go through and marshal the assets and figure out, you know, the universe of creditors and debts that the individual who has passed away. So this would be, you know, part of that process. So hopefully during the course of looking through and making that determination in terms of, well, you know, what that relative had in terms of, you know, outstanding debts to other creditors or whatever else in the course of that process, that they would discover that the unit existed, and then, you know, do some direct outreach with the owner to apprise them of the situation. And certainly to the extent that the owner is made aware, certainly the vast majority, if not all, would be more than happy and willing to work with that individual and appreciating that, you know, that has to kind of run its way through the probate system before it could be turned over. So,
so I would just know we actually have one person who's called in for public testimony. I would suggest, because I think we're not completely out of questions, but why don't we open up for public testimony, take public testimony, close public testimony, then return to some questions. The public testimony may prompt some additional questions that we can come back to the question. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on House Bill 331. Is there anyone in the room who'd like to provide public testimony on House Bill 331? Seeing no one in the room, we also have one person that's called in, Sharon Beeman. Calling, I think, from North Pole. Ms. Beeman, if you want to identify yourself for the record, any affiliation you might have, and you can proceed with public testimony. We generally limit public testimony to 2 minutes, but I recognize because you're at least listed identified affiliated with Forbes Storage, we may have some questions for you. Please proceed with your public testimony.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Beeman. I work at Forbes Storage in North Pole. And I've worked here for about 6 or 7 years. And in looking over the bill, I agree primarily with the previous caller. I do have some issues with some of the language. On page 2, line 27, it says, facility owner shall mail a lien notice to the unit renter. And I will reiterate what he said. Sometimes when these accounts go in arrears, that address is not accurate. People generally do not change their email address. So my preference would be to put an addition there of a facility owner shall mail or electronically email a lien notice to the renter, and that lets the unit holder know that their unit is in the auction process. I think it's in these days a better avenue to get a hold of the owners of the unit. And then on page 8, lines 12 and 13, it's the facility owner shall call the unit renter and mail the notice to the unit renter's postal address and electronic mail address provided to the facility owner. I would encourage the change from and to or. And
this is online. Those are, is it on page 8?
I believe it's on page 8. It's 34.35.695.
I think that's...
It says that the facility owner shall call the unit renter and mail the notice to the unit renter's postal address and electronic mail address provided to the facility owner.
I think we're on page 7.
Page 7. Which lines represented?
I think.
Okay, I see. Yep, it is line 7. Line 12 and 13 on line page 7. Okay.
Found it.
You can
great.
Keep going.
So, and I'm gonna, I would just encourage the change from and to or.
Okay. Any other further testimony? I'm giving you a little more time than we usually give public testimony because you're giving very specific issues on the bill as opposed to a broad opinion.
In listening to all of the questions, our facility itself, and I know that the representatives are really concerned about the time frame of how long the auction process is. And I can tell you for our facility up there, I certainly can't speak for all of the other ones in the state, but normally what happens is the default may be 10 days, but that's default of payment. So if you're in default of payment, that doesn't mean it, that the unit goes into auction right away. What we do is we call and try and collect payment. Then 20 days, 21 days later, we cut the lock on the unit. And then 30 days after that lock is cut, that's when the auction actually occurs. So it's like a 2-month process.
Do you have other testimony? Because I know I have some questions. I bet other members have some questions. Do you have other testimony you would want to provide before we get you going on questions?
The cost of some of these requirements is almost getting insurmountable. So even if we auction the unit, we still have to recoup our costs from the newspaper ad and the mailings, which can be quite extensive. And if we're supposed to get an appraiser to appraise everything that's in the unit, even if it's trash, then it's just insurmountable. And I'm open to questions.
Okay. Questions from members of the committee? I have a couple of questions and then others may. So right now when you, well, I've rented storage units at different points over time, and I always sign this pretty extensive agreement that details all kinds of things. How is your current, for the business that you're involved with, and I'm not worried about other businesses in the state because you're the only storage person we have on the phone right now. What controls that whole process? Is it the contract that you enter into with everyone, or are there state statutes that require how you approach what happens now when, you know, when I say I'm renting my storage unit for $100 a month and I don't pay 1 month? Is it strictly the contract that drives the next steps? Are you constrained by state law? And if so, how?
It is the contract and it's common policy. So our contract says that if we don't have payment within 6 days, there's a $10 late fee. So that's part of that. So that's our default. And then, but we wait for the next month before we start that auction process. So somebody's in arrears to us for at least 1 month.
But is there anything that it's the contract that would give me the month if I'm late? It's not, you're not saying, oh, statute requires me to give you a month. It's the contract I signed that gives you the month.
No, because Alaska doesn't have lien laws.
And does that also mean, how about the notice in newspapers? Is that something that you're required to do, or is that in your contract?
No, right now it's not in the lease. Let me look here. I just grabbed one. It's not in the lease. But it's common practice. And we take most of the things that we do off of the vehicle storage rules, the regulations for us to be able to sell a vehicle.
And then would it be possible for you to send a copy of your current agreement to Representative Tuck's office? It looks like Representative Prox may already have it.
He does.
Okay, then you don't need to provide it again. Okay. I think those were the questions. Well, actually, one in working in the storage unit, are you getting complaints from the consumers, the people that are renting from you, saying that the way in which you're proceeding to foreclose when they haven't paid rent is unfair, or are you not getting a lot of complaints that way from the people that rent?
We've never had a complaint today about the way the auction process occurs. And we do not, so if you've ever seen Storage Wars, that's pretty much what we do. We open the door, and our auctions are online, so we open the door, we take pictures, we write down what we can see, and we never enter the unit. And then we close the door, we put our lock on it, and then the information is put online when the auction comes up. And we try and put the auction online at least 1 week before the start date of the auction.
And are you advertising, whether it be online advertisements or in newspapers, are you doing those advertisements to notify the renter that they're about to lose their stuff? Or are you putting those online and in newspapers to let people know there's an auction and if they're interested, they should show up to buy?
The latter.
Does that get, because anybody else have questions for Ms. Beeman? Representative Eastman, looks like, yep.
Thank you, through the chair. So I know the presentation of the bill spoke to the fact that these are just month-to-month leases, but, you know, under current law, you have opportunities for longer-term leases than that, I would assume. What are your maximum options as far as how long a lease for a storage unit can be?
Ours is month-to-month.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see anyone else online for public testimony. We're going to... Oh, do we have another one? They're pointing. Is there somebody else online for public testimony? I only see Mr. Beeman. Let's brief at ease. Back on record. We have one more person calling in. Mr. Brewer, if you want to state your name for the record, let us know where you're calling from and provide any affiliation you may have, and you can proceed with your public testimony. Our practice is to limit it to 2 minutes, but if you turn out, well, I may extend it depending on what kind of information we're hearing. Go ahead, Mr. Brewer.
Okay. I'm Brewer. I'm in Fairbanks, and I own Fairbanks Storage LLC. And I just received your offer. There, Barbara Haney, and thought I'd call in. I had a couple issues with the bill. First of all, I'm definitely for it. I feel like we are lacking like the rules to abide by, to follow. So basically, when my company started up, I kind of took rules from Washington and California, and kind of that's what I've been basing it off of. So I definitely think this makes sense so that everybody knows what we should follow. I also have apartments, and there's definitely, you know, a Landlord-Tenant Act all scripted out. Helps a lot. I think this could help a lot for the storages. One of my biggest issues with it was section 34-35.625, the lien notice, section 11, and then the 34.35.685, the restricted property. I guess I must ask, why would a firearm and ammunition be considered restricted property? Whenever there's a gun part of a storage lien in the past, I have just brought the gun to the local law enforcement agency, Fairbanks Police Department. They've run the serial number, and if it comes back clean, then the firearm remains part of the lien process and is legally sold along with other items to help recover past due fees. If the weapon was stolen, then it becomes restricted property and the local law enforcement agency seizes it at that point. This is normal industry practice, and I think it makes the most sense. The firearms only become restricted property if they are considered stolen. As of now, this House Bill 331 would allow the owner to recover the firearm and ammunition from the local agency within 1 year and the storage business owner would not be able to recover the assets offset the lien costs. I fully understand that the controlled substances are restricted property, but as a gun rights supporter, I feel that considering a clean, not stolen firearm, and especially ammunition, as restricted property is unconstitutional. So that was my first issue with that. And then I had one other part of it too here. It's section 34.35.635, the disposal publication in section 1. And House Bill 331 is asking that the storage business publish the notice of sale one time before the date of the sale in a local newspaper. I'd like to stress to you all that posting this notice in the local classified is cost prohibitive for the majority of lien notices. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner advertising rates just add another huge expense to us as the lien process that rarely gets paid or met. My business, along with some others in Fairbanks, follow other state rules that allow the notice of the public sale to be posted in 3 public locations, including the 2 nearest post offices and at the office of the storage facility. I feel that just as many people see this notice posted at the local post offices as those who read the local classified. I personally have not started using online publications, but I feel that Facebook Marketplace and Craigslist should also be alternative options to the costly local newspaper advertising. So that's my 2 issues. I caught onto this late, so I'm not sure if you guys have discussed either of those yet at this moment, but that's all I have for now.
We've been discussing a lot. I see Representative Eastman has questions for you, so don't go anywhere. And Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair.
Okay.
Yes, the restricted definition, I think, is well put. Thank you for your testimony on that. And I also wanted to ask, similar to the last caller, what is the longest amount of time that you would currently allow someone to either sign a lease or make an agreement to store their property?
So all ours are monthly leases for storage. All of our apartments are 12-month leases, but for storage it's just month to month. And then they have to give they pay monthly, and it's a 10-day notice from either my side or from them that they want to vacate the unit. So it's very short term.
Follow up?
Thank you. And so do you have many customers that, you might not see for a while, like, their seasonal work might take them out of cell phone range or what have you, and so the 10-day notice, I mean, you can send it to them, but you already know it ahead of time that it's not going to get to them, you know, quickly.
Yes, there's no doubt. So right now, after 10 days, I consider it late. I charge a $10 late fee, and then I'm a little more lenient. I go 60 days out. After 60 days, then I start the lien process, and I post it at the 2 post offices and at our local facility, and I also certify mail it to them and email it to them, and that gives them 30 days to come in and pay their balance before it goes into a lien. If I still have not heard from them 3 days after that 30 days is up, I have the sale within 3 days after that. So I just cover my bases with everything, but it just adds costs. You know, by the time I certify mail and notify everybody and then do the sale, you know, the majority of the time, that's what I was, you know, pressing to Representative Prax, is that, like, most of the time there's not much value in these units that are left behind. You know, it's very infrequent where somebody leaves valuable items in and just doesn't pay for them. So most of the time we're spending more money doing these certified mailings, these advertisements, holding the public sale than what the value is even in the unit. So I'd like to stress that. It's not like it's a gear. Like, I don't, it costs more money than I will ever recoup having one of these lien sales. I'm better off being more friendly with them and letting, like, even giving them an extra 30 days to pay. I'd rather collect that extra $100 in monthly rent rather than lose more money, you know, spending good money to try to get bad.
Follow up through the chair.
Representative Eastman.
And have you had situations where, you know, you go through that process and dispose of the property or sell the property, and someone comes back and says, you know, wait, I didn't realize that you were, you know, doing that. If I had known, I would have stopped you, kind of a thing.
I have not. I've had a couple people upset that it sold, but they all understand the rules, and they didn't have money at that time to pay for it. I've never had anybody come forward and say, hey, I never got any of your mailing, heard from you, or any of that part.
Thank you.
So just in summary of that last, you had people that were unhappy. They lost their stuff, but they weren't unhappy with you about the way that occurred because they knew they hadn't paid rent and they couldn't.
Exactly. And they had received the notice, or, you know, sometimes the certified mail comes back returned, and that's why I do the email too, you know, and I think email's a lot easier and quicker, and maybe more people view that, but I also see how that can get lost, you know, on somebody's junk folder or accidentally deleting it too. So that's why I also do the certified mail part of it and phone call them also. So I try all three means of method, you know, because I understand if some, you know, if you lost all your stuff, you'd be very upset about it.
Just for the record, you know, I just want to make mention that the timelines that he's following seem to be a little more generous than in the statute, the bill. So understandable that he wouldn't get a lot of complaints.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Brewer. I don't see anyone else online. I'm checking to make sure that somebody doesn't. Okay. We're going to close public testimony on House Bill 331. And that we'll get back to questions from committee members.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Tucker.
I just want to go over the timeline of what happened. That was a question earlier. And I didn't have it at my fingertips at the time. But if you take a look at page 2, lines 17 and 18, where it says, a facility owner may enforce a storage lien after a unit renter has been continuously in default for at least 10 days. So there's 10 days right there. And then on the next page, on page 3, line 2 and 3, demand that the unit renter cure the default, so they're in default, before the date stated in the lien notice. The date for curing the default must be not less than 21 days. So there's the 21 days. And then, if you will, authority to dispose unit property, going on to page 4. And that's a disposal publication advertising and notices. If you look at line 15, that's the advertiser sale one time a week for 2 weeks. So there's another 2 weeks there. And then after that is when the 5 days kicks in on line, page 5, line 11.
And Mason. If I may, through the chair, Mike Mason, staff to Representative Chris Tuck, going to the last caller. Where they were talking about the publication. So on page 4, line 13 through 17, the first three lines deal with the publication in the general circulation, the newspaper of general circulation, and then it goes to or advertise the sale one time a week for 2 weeks in a commercially reasonable manner. So you have options. You don't have to do both. You can do both, but you have options. You don't have to do one or the other.
Representative Kirk,
I think you had a question. Maybe not.
Yes, to the chair. From the association, we've been hearing a lot from, I guess, how much have they talked to, I guess, Alaskan rental owners for this draft?
I'm not sure whether that's – well, we'll start with Mr. Bryant. Have you been talking with Alaska self-storage owners in working on the draft? How many folks from Alaska have you spoken with in working on this draft legislation? Or it's not draft, it's proposed legislation.
Mr. Chairman, we have one member who actually just recently procured a facility who's based primarily down in Louisiana, who we've been having conversations with. And he's been going around and having conversations with some local owners in the state. But the answer is very few at this point.
And I'll ask the same question. Representative Tuck, have you been talking with self-storage owners, self-storage facility owners in working on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair.
The original bill that we were about to introduce was worked on over a couple of years with a facility owner.
Okay. With one or multiple facilities?
One facility owner, and then prior to that was an appraiser.
Okay. Representative Vance, I think you had your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is question is for the sponsor of the bill. This is page 4, line 18, talking about the unit property, if the unit property is a vehicle. Do you have any place in the bill that talks about if it's a watercraft or a boat where, you know, the facility owner could dispose of that? Because that, I can see, would be a great concern.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Vance, give me just one quick moment because we have definitions of that, which includes watercraft and also includes trailers. Okay, if you look at, well, here's a definition of wet watercraft. It's on page 10, line 20. But I got to find the section that refers to that definition. Oh. Yeah, let's take a look at page 5 under the heading Redemption by Unit Renter, Vehicle Owner, or Vehicle Lien Holder, line 18. It says vehicle there, vehicle. I just saw a bunch of watercraft sections in my eyes earlier.
My concern is if there was a need to sell it, do we have that included?
I'll have to look for it, but the bill does include watercraft, trailers, and of course vehicles is RVs and everything else that goes along in there. So basically anything you can park or store on a trailer is also included into this bill.
The reference to watercraft and vehicles, I think, appears to be on page 2, lines 22 to 25. It's in subsection 2, makes some reference to vehicle or watercraft.
Oh, there you go.
A follow-up question,
please,
that I have for that is, if the unit owner is moving that property and it gets damaged in the process of being moved, who is liable for those damages?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question, but I know talking with facility owners, they do not like moving vehicles. And this is when they absolutely have to, because of snow removal or because it's blocking another vehicle that they need to get access to. But I can tell you that they do not, because of that liability, do not like to move them. I guess it would be the same liability that they would have if they were storing something and they ran into it with their forklift. I assume it'd be about the same liability.
Follow-up?
Representative Vance.
Is it common for facilities to have insurance to cover for such damages? Is it required?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I would have to ask Daniel Bryant on that one if he happens to know.
Mr. Bryant.
Yes, the answer is absolutely yes. They would have insurance to cover those types of issues.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if someone can speak to how this bill will apply to property that is being stored by a member of our armed forces who might be deployed overseas.
I would like to punt again, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bryant.
Happy to answer the question, Mr. Chair. So as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, the Service Member Civil Relief Act precludes enforcement of any storage liens in all 50 states for active duty service members. So everything that we're talking about today in terms of this bill wouldn't apply to an active duty service member. And the only way that an owner is permitted to enforce their lien is getting a court order to that effect. So the self-help remedy envisioned in this statute wouldn't apply to somebody who's active duty. And again, we encourage all of our members to have an express provision in their rental agreement that, that asks the prospective tenant to disclose their status in the military and even beyond that, to the extent there's even, you know, some question as to whether or not they are a member. We encourage everybody to run the information through the DOD just to make that confirmation. Because, again, if you make a misstep, there are civil and criminal liabilities that attach as a result of violation of that particular federal statute.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, I remember when I had deployed from Alaska, there was property that I left in the care of others, and I see that the federal law, you know, protects the belongings of a deployed service member, you know, regardless of who it is that is, you know, paying for the rental unit. How does the bill currently ensure that owners of these facilities know that, you know, some portion of property, you know, belongs to that military member so that they don't inadvertently break federal law in disposing of it or whatnot?
So we would generally speak, Mr. Chair, encourage the provision to be a little bit more expansive, to say, you know, if any of the contents of the unit owned by an active duty service member. So that would hopefully capture somebody beyond just the individual tenant to again, apprise that unit owner that there is property stored in that unit that is owned by an active duty service member.
Representative Eastman.
And is that currently in the bill, or is that, again, just advice that you give to owners of facilities?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there's anything that speaks specifically to that in this bill currently. Certainly would be happy to work something in to make sure that that is sort of driven home. But again, just in terms of our recommendations and best practices, we certainly drill that with all of our members just to make sure that they're exceptionally cautious with any unit property that might be owed by an active duty service member, whether they are the tenant or, you know, just storing something else in another unit. But again, certainly happy to work with the sponsor and this committee to you know, potentially tighten that up a bit.
Thank you.
Now, that, Mr. Bryant, that raises sort of, I would describe as a sort of peculiar loophole that could potentially swallow the whole bill. So let's, under the Service Members Civil Relief Act, if I'm the renter who wants to essentially protect myself from not only from paying rent but from an owner that I don't really want to pay rent to, I go to the owner and I say, well, this is claim and storage unit and I've rented it, but I just want you to know that my colleague Representative Eastman, who's a deployed military member, he's got this old stereo unit that he asked me to store for him. So I have this stereo component sitting in the storage unit that belongs to a service member and he's overseas. So just want you to know that. Have a good day. It seems to me in that scenario that not only is Representative Eastman giving me his stereo component so nothing happens to it while he's deployed, but it seems to me I've got kind of carte blanche to never pay rent until Representative Eastman comes back, even though he's not on the lease. That seems like a kind of a strange loophole, but it seems like one that you're suggesting exists. As long as the storage unit owner, not the renter, but if the owner knows that I've got that service member's property in the unit, the owner can't do anything.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize if I presented this as like a common occurrence. It is not. Again, I am not aware of anyone who is intentionally housing property from a service member to circumvent the requirement to pay their rent on time. So again, to my knowledge, that has not presented a significant or otherwise issue for, you know, the vast majority of our members nationally. Again, I just more just under. Just generally speaking, if there is concern about, you know, service members, just again to exercise great caution, and to the extent that somebody makes a representation regarding status. We certainly encourage people to follow up, and get information regarding, where they're stationed and other things, just to basically fact check the claim that this individual is in fact an active duty service member. But to address the initial question, again, I'm not presently aware of anyone in any state who is, sort of actively trying to circumvent the requirement to pay rent by claiming that there is some, property stored in the unit by an active duty service member.
Any other questions from members of the committee? We'll get a chance to consider this bill more in the future. The one thing I think might be helpful the next time we hear this bill would be to get a little bit more of a description of the status quo. We've heard from a couple of storage unit owners. I know Representative Prox is with us today, and I know he's got particular interest in this bill. I think he signed as a co-sponsor, but I think he'd be interested in a little more presentation of the status quo. You don't need to tell us today because we're kind of running short on time, but I would like to see more of that, how they're managing without this law. And unless there's...
I just real quick respond to that, Mr. Chair. Just like the gentleman to testify earlier that said he based his on Washington, California. The gentleman that I worked with this bill previously was also doing the same thing. So a lot of them just modeled themselves after other states.
Right. Well, that's kind of what I suspect. All right. Well, I don't see anything else. So we are going to hold this bill for further review. And we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, March 18th at 1 p.m. On Friday, we're going to be here. Invited testimony from Microsoft on privacy legislation broadly, as well as their perspective on House Bill 159. If you have questions for Microsoft in advance of the hearing, please let us know by close of business today. And it doesn't have to be anything indeed, but if there's particular interest on privacy you'd like to make sure they know about, let us know. And what I would actually ask you to do is that you get that information to us. If you let us know by noon tomorrow, we'll forward it to Microsoft so they can address those questions. You'll still be able to ask other questions, but if you have questions that you might want them to prepare a little bit more in advance, just let my office know and we'll forward it to Microsoft. And with that, we'll stand adjourned. The time is now 1:45 or 2:45 p.m.